The following talk is offered freely to ensure that no one is ever denied access to these practices and to these teachings. If you feel inspired to make a donation to support this offering, you can go to my website at jonathanfaust.com. While you're there, you can also sign up for a monthly newsletter designed to support you in your practice. Thank you, and enjoy.
There's a story out there about this guy decides he's struggling so much in his life, he finally takes the plunge and goes to see a therapist. And as he's explaining all the challenges and everything he's going through, the therapist says, "Well, this is pretty clear to me. You have an overactive inner critic that's giving you low self-esteem." The guy said, "Well, you know, it feels really good to have it diagnosed." And the therapist said, "Oh, yeah, it's quite common among losers." Isn't that a horrible joke? I'd like to talk about the inner critic tonight, because the inner critic is a voice that can paralyze you. It's a voice that can predict your future for you. And how you relate to the inner critic can really make a difference in your view of life. We have this nonstop barrage of critical thoughts, maybe you've noticed. And sometimes when you practice meditation, it seems like they're even more chronic. But in truth, they're there a lot. We're just not aware of them. So I'd like to talk about the negativity bias that's built right in, and to talk about the birth of the petty dictator. Like, where does that ruthless inner critic come from? What are its origins? And it has its origins in pretty clearly in philosophy and scripture. And then to talk about the awakening of discernment. How do you wake up out of the trance of the inner critic? And then how do you live from a place of wise discernment? So if you imagine that you were a forager here a millennia ago, and it was this time of year, you'd be very, very hungry. And imagine one morning you go out and there are these beautiful yellow flowers with a little fruit on them. And everything in you wants to eat that because it looks good. But something in you says, maybe not, wait, just wait a little bit. And then along, there comes someone who's really hungry, they eat one of those yellow flowers, and they die. We are a product of that kind of brain, of exploring what's going to kill us. And it's a really interesting thing to see how much of our life is formed on self-protection. You know, if you ever raise a toast with your friends at the table, well, the origins of that are, I'll pour a little bit of my drink into yours, you pour a little bit into mine, so if you poison me, you're going to get poisoned too. You know, shaking hands is a gesture of taking your strongest hand and making it vulnerable, which is why left-handed people are not to be trusted. I'm a left-handed person, sorry, you know? Sinistra is left-handed. So you know that reflex? The one that the voice that's saying, okay, what could possibly go wrong if you do this? Let's take a minute and think about the worst that could happen. That is that built-in negativity bias. That's just part of our psyche. It's naturally self-protectional and self-preservational. One time on a meditation retreat, if you do a longer retreat, you have some private interviews and then an interview with a group. And there was someone, a woman in this group, who had been really kind of experiencing sort of a self-paralysis of negative self-talk during her meditation. And she could never understand why she couldn't achieve more in life, really held back. And someone else in the group started to describe kind of the voices that she was hearing too. This voice saying, I'll never be as good as other people. I'm not worthy of being successful in this life. I'm not attractive enough. I'm not smart enough. And this woman said she heard this woman reporting out those voices, and she recognized that, of course, as her voices. And she realized that was always in the background, that negative, critical thinking. And that became a real focus for her on that retreat, to really investigate that voice, to really ask, where does this come from? This voice is so familiar, but I can't quite place the origin of that voice. So I'd like to talk a little bit about how she worked with that and how you can work with it too, which has to do with just recognizing and seeing the presence of that inner critic and to recognize how much of it is a habit. And also to look at how to befriend that voice, how to be more intimate with it. Over the course of that week, she began to recognize that critic didn't have to be an enemy, that there was actually some kind of an ally to that voice that really shifted her experience. And she also sensed there was something very familiar about that voice. And it wasn't until later that she recognized where the origin of that voice came from. So how does that voice get so strong? How does it get to be so influential in your life? I had mentioned before one quick way to see the imprinting of your parents or your primary caretakers is to complete the following phrase. One thing my father or mother always said about money is, fill in the blank, and then ask yourself, am I living from that belief myself? For many of us, we begin to see like, oh my gosh, that has really shaped my life. My parents grew up in the Depression, and they really, they actually enjoyed their frugality, I think. But I remember when they were in their 70s, they were going to be driving from their home in Maine out to Colorado. They had a Ford Explorer, you know, SUV at that time. My parents were quite educated, both advanced degrees. My dad was an English professor. And so he was telling me, I said, how long will it take? He said, 4 or 5 days. I said, so you're going to stay in hotels along the way? And he gave me this incredulous look, and he said, we have the Explorer. Second, why would you pay $75 when you could just have that great car you can sleep in? So that is still an influence on me. I still have a car I can sleep in. When you begin to ask yourself, from where does that inner critic come from? You can look to your conditioning. And as I reflected on my parents and their influence on that inner critic, my father was sort of the baby of the family. He knew he was very loved, and he kind of went through life as a well-wisher of all. And my mother was not so easy. She had lived with a lot of the inner critic. Her parents really wanted a boy, and they got her. Super critical family. Her mother was the head nurse of surgery in a in a hospital in Boston and ran her family exactly the same way. And I'm aware of those elements of my own character structure, of what I just picked up. And then there's the general culture. When you look at the school you went to, the friends you hung out with, what signals, what voices did you pick up that reflected some form of self-criticism? I grew up on a farm in the Pennsylvania Dutch country, and my neighbors were all farm kids, and we were all into hunting and cars and that kind of culture. And then it no longer really resonated for me, and I got guns as part of my indoctrination into manhood, but found myself kind of repulsed by the whole that whole thing, and let that go, and started enjoying reading, which, from what I understand, has direct relationship to my sexual orientation, from my friends back then. And luckily, I got into a culture that was very supportive of what I was interested in. But it is an interesting thing to reflect on. So a short reflection, if you will. You can close your eyes. You might like to deepen and lengthen your breath. Relax on the out-breath. And as you reflect on your primary caretakers, how free, how happy were they? How did they suffer or experience stress? And is there a sense of anything they may have passed on to you or imprinted you with as to what to believe about yourself or to believe about life? How did they caution you? And as you sense going through your young childhood and through school, how did you compare yourself to others? How afraid were you of failing? And how desirous were you of for being seen as a success? And just sensing how active and how subtle those memories may be in your system. Perhaps not so strong, perhaps you feel them somewhat predominant. So if you like, you can deepen the breath. As we naturally go through life, we kind of take on more. You know? But there's one of the most beautiful articulations of how this forms is beautifully described through yoga philosophy, through the kleshas. And there are five elements to the formation of a self. And the very first one is referred to as avidya, which is wrong knowledge or ignorance. And that is, and you think of yourself coming into form as a human being. You're coming into consciousness in this tiny little body. And at some point, you recognize that you are a separate being. At some point, you realize you have a name. You are singled out for being you. And that forgetting of your true nature from where you come is kind of the beginning. Then imagine as you're going through as a toddler, you're then moving into what's called asmita, which is the formation of a self. It's the formation of an ego. And that gets strengthened. As you go through life, you keep looking for more and more evidence that you are this separate being. naturally a view of experiences, then you begin to experience what's referred to as raga and dvesha, which is the things that you like that give you pleasure and the things you dislike that you move away from. And that continues to inform you as a separate self. I like this, I move toward that. I'm repulsed by that, I move away from that. And as you go through life, developing the strengthening sense of a separate self, your list of what you like and what you don't like, it's longer and longer, which is why I notice many, many people as they get up toward the upper end of the life, their range of comfort has gotten so small because they're really pushed out by the likes and the dislikes. That leads to the fifth klesha, which is abhinivesha, which is the fear of death. That the more identified and attached to who you are as the separate story, to the degree you are holding on, you will fear the letting go. So that inner critic, that inner voice, is that voice of a separate being that is driven by the desires and the fears. And the beautiful thing about mindfulness, about cultivating non-judging awareness, is you get to see into the nature and the formation of that self. And you get to see how much of it is impermanent and constantly changing. You become less and less identified with those stories. And the more you let go, the more you feel free. The more capacity you have for joy and happiness in the here and now. So we pick up this inner critic as we pick up our story, our sense of self. And just as it's created, it can be released, which is the good news. And so as we go through life in this social world, we're constantly caught in comparison and judgment. You may have noticed that for most people, the more time you spend on Facebook, the worse you feel. Because you're seeing everyone present their very best self to the world, and you naturally feel less and less connected to yourself. So what is the shift from being identified and ruled by the separate self and the inner critic and being free? Well, it has to do with what I think of as the miracle of mindfulness, your capacity to be self-aware. Another time on a retreat for an individual interview, someone came in and said, this has been one of the hardest days of my life. So I really come to believe that I will never be in a happy relationship. I'm too damaged. I'm too old. I'm too needy. I just get caught in these depressive, needy cycles. And I'm really seeing that that just isn't going to happen. And so I asked her if she was really, really wanted to explore that, really investigate that. And so I asked her, so the thought is you'll never be in a happy relationship. And she said, yeah. So I asked her a few questions, which I know I've shared with you before. The first question, is it true? Is it true that you'll never be in a happy relationship? And she said, well, the evidence points in that direction. I said, well, but do you absolutely know it's true? And then she thought about it, said, no, I don't absolutely believe it, I guess. And I asked her if she'd be willing to investigate the thought. So I asked her, so when you think that thought and you believe it, that you'll never be in a happy relationship, what's that like on the inside? And she began to describe this deep, deep heaviness and a deep, deep sadness and a profound sense of kind of like a falling in. And as she described it, I invited her to really describe it in detail, but then also to explore, what if she were to hold that with a little tender kindness, with a little compassion or a little bit of empathy? And as she did, something began to lighten a little bit. Lots of tears. But then I asked her, just to go back to that thought, that you'll never be in a happy relationship. Who are you without that thought? And there was just a pause. And for a little while, not a long time, but for a little while, she looked like she was about 7 years old. Just this deep sense of lightness, of possibility. It's a profound inquiry. And it's one you can do sometimes when you hear that voice and you can identify some belief going on in there. It's really bringing discrimination to that very thought. Is it true? And rather than to turn from the natural paralysis that arises, to with some rigor investigate the specificity of that belief and whether it's true. And the real fruit, when you have the time and the energy and the awareness, is to really explore that thought. How old is it? How far back can you trace that thought? And the real magic is calling on loving presence, calling on compassion, empathy. It's the lubrication that really allows you to feel it and release it. So that practice is one that can lead to profound insight sometimes. And part of it is this recognition, and inevitably this will become part of your practice in meditation. As the witness arises, as your capacity to observe without judgment gets stronger, the more you'll recognize that you don't have to believe every thought. It happens to me almost every retreat I go to. I don't have to believe every thought. Whoa, is there a lot of freedom in there? The truth is that you have the capacity to be aware of your thoughts and to recognize that inner critic. Some of the voices of the inner critic, or the ruthless critic as I think of it, is when you find yourself wondering if people like you, or you're feeling anxiety about being competent at what you're doing, or you're concerned about being perfect or being seen as perfect. If you're afraid of making mistakes, apprehensive of what other people think about you, or feel some shame from the past, that's a feeding ground for the critic. So there's an interesting description of the inner critic. It says that this is an internalized authority figure that overrides and intimidates and paralyzes you into silence. The healing occurs when you can really see it and express it. So the question becomes, what do you do when you're caught in that critic? And I've also worked sometimes with, I remember working with someone once where she was very aware of this critical thinking mind, just always churning. And as we sort of dialogued with it, and she really saw like, oh, this is just internalized stuff I picked up, you know, from my mother. And she began to be able to recognize it more and more clearly and realize she didn't have to believe it all the time. And she said, I just hate this inner voice. And she was about to go off on a big trip and was very anxious, and like the critic was really, really ramping up. And so she was sort of exploring, and I said, well, how much of the inner critic would you just want to get rid of? And she thought for a long time. She goes, well, none of it, actually. I really need it. I'm going to need it for this trip. And there's a very interesting thing of how the inner critic is actually an ally. It's actually there looking out for you. But sometimes the equation gets a little bit imbalanced. So how do we work from a discriminating mind where we can really begin to see what the real voice of the critic and to be aware of it without fear? As I mentioned before, I lived on the edge of the Sahara Desert in Niger, West Africa, in the Peace Corps. And during the mid part of my time there, I met this fellow. I saw this fellow on a bike, a long-distance biker, which you just never see in Africa. And so I kind of pulled over, and we talked for a while, and I invited him back to my place. And he stayed with me for about a month. He was actually kind of sick from his travels. But he had just ridden his bicycle across the Sahara. His name was Kevin Hickey, and he got me really inspired to do the same thing. So this was before mountain bikes. This was back like 81, 82. And there, you know, no shocks or sealed bearings or anything. But I just took off. I took a bike, and we tied and soldered the spokes. And I had to repack the bearings all the time because of the sand and dirt. But I trained really well. I was in really good shape. And it was just a time in my life where I wanted to do something heroic and totally insane. And before I took off, the hot season was particularly intense. And it would get very hot. 130 was not uncommon. And there were these harmattan winds, these dust-laden winds coming down from Algeria, and they were particularly bad too. And I suddenly was overwhelmed with, what are you doing, you moron? You know, you're not strong enough. You're going out unsupported, you know, into the desert. And you're going to get imbalanced, you're going to get a migraine, you're going to be helpless on the side of the road, and this on and on and on. It's a lot of fear. But I had been telling everyone for 2 years that I was going to do it. That was a huge force. At one point I thought, is my ego just going to go out there and obliterate myself because it said it would? So I was hating that part of that self-judgmental process. And I remember actually asking myself, could I actually be kind to that intense voice? And the fear was that I was going to do something really stupid. But when I really was sort of able to drop my reaction to it, I was able to really see clearly that I really was about to do something stupid. And I ended up trying anyway. I emphasize the word try. But there's something about when you feel the inner critic, every coin has two sides. On the one side, it may be part of your conditioning. Just that anxious, negative bias quality of mind that may be very organic and healthy. And there may be something to it, something in your conditioning that is actually holding you back. But the only way you can really discern when you feel the critic present is to investigate it, to really explore what of this is coming from fear. Is there something here about a fear of dying or a fear of losing control or a fear of losing attention and affection? Or is there something here in this voice which really has a message for me that I should really pay attention to? The challenge is when we fight it, there's no possibility of deeper understanding. What I find when I kind of examine that there's something in my life I'd like to do, but I can feel the inner critic, that I really come to see there are different parts in all of us. As someone said so wisely, you're actually run by committee. You know, that there is something inside you is the warrior and wants to make yourself do it because it'll know it'll be good for you. And then there's the voice of fear. There's the voice of the critic. Sorting those out can be really, really helpful. So I thought again we might do a short reflection just to investigate a little bit of this. And again, you might feel the breath. And you might just reflect, you know, just at this time of your life. Is there something going on in your life where there may be some form of inner criticism? Maybe there's a situation in your life where there's something inside that wants to do something, and yet something inside that is holding you back or not so sure. And when you think about how you're holding your life now or a particular issue, is there some form of fear or anxiety with which you're holding it? If you were able to identify that doubting or critical mind, what would it be saying? And if you can sense this quality of the ruthless critic or the doubter, is it possible to let it know you see it? Is it possible in some way to offer it some quality of friendliness or kindness? And as you reflect on this quality of the critic in your life, can you sense its origins? For some, they might sense it with their culture or with family. Some sense it going back for countless generations. One of the most powerful elements there is for transformation is calling on loving presence of compassion or kindness. You might, in your own way, only if this works for you, just acknowledge and thank this quality of the critic as your protector, as an ally, wanting you to live your life fully. And as you sense this time in your life, or maybe this particular issue, if that's what you're investigating, with this quality of a relaxed heart, what advice do you have to give yourself? And if you were to do that, not perfectly, not all the time, what might that be like? In your own time, you can deepen your breath. And if you like, you can let your eyes open. It's been said there are two main forces that inform our life. One is fear, which is around self-preservation. And one is creativity and love, which is about expansion. In that same way, there are two manifestations of the critic. One is that voice of fear. It's telling you you're not enough or don't even try. It's all about self-preservation. And then there is wise discrimination. That is the capacity to see clearly without fear. It's a very different world. That ruthless critic may say, pay attention because something bad may happen. But if you were to live from that same place, from a place of openness, from a place of wisdom, from a place of compassion, it's a very different journey. There's greater ease, there's greater mobility, there's the capacity to be improvised as you move your way through life. So just as this critic is formed, this self is formed, so it can pass away. And one way to see more clearly into the critic is simply to start noticing and to name it when it's there. As soon as you recognize that process of the inner critic, you've broken the cycle, if just for a moment. Sometimes when I work with people really about the inner critic, I'll invite them to give it a name. And so they can say, oh, God, there goes Vernon. There's something about the objectifying of it that can be helpful. No offense to any Vernons out there. As they say, if you can name something, you take its power away. So that's that quality of clear seeing. It's one of the benefits when you really settle the mind and come into present moment awareness, relax and feel an open awareness, you begin to become more aware of how subtle that voice of criticism and self-protection is. And you can name it and see it, and it will lose its grip, not all the time, but little by little. That's wisdom. The other is the wise heart. And that is bringing empathy and compassion to that quality. That can be so powerful, particularly when you recognize how long that voice has been there, when you recognize the seeds of that voice and see into all the conditions around it and hold all of it with kindness and compassion. Not easy, but a very powerful way of helping it on its way, helping to release its clutch. Another way is to see the critic as a servant and not as a master. And to sense, is there a message in this that I might sense a little bit deeper rather than just hating this critical voice? And one of the most helpful things is to share what that critic is saying, That's maybe the most vulnerable thing you can do. But there's something very, very powerful when you might say, you know, there's just something inside telling me that I'm not worthy of your friendship, or whatever it may be. When you name it, very vulnerable place to go, but it's a very powerful way of releasing it. It's a very therapeutic process. So all of these practices are about freedom, about finding a sense of resourcefulness and happiness and joy where it may not have existed before. And when you tune in to the presence of the ruthless critic and begin to sense, where is there a quality of wisdom and wise discernment here, it takes you very deep into all the places where you're not free. And that's what this practice is all about. I'd like to end with a quote from Matthieu Ricard, who's a Tibetan monk. He's a wonderful writer. He talks a little bit about inner freedom. So if you like, you can close your eyes. A few words about this cultivation of freedom. You start with freedom from thirst and hunger and disease, the basic freedoms that the state has helped its citizens to achieve. Then you go beyond that to social freedom from discrimination, inequality, from lawlessness and insecurity, which the state also has to provide. And then you move up the ladder to political freedom, from freedom from authority and tyranny. And then you move even past that, freedom from internal bondage. As much as you may sense that judging, critical mind that at times may paralyze you or hold you back, in that same way, you might sense who you are free from that limiting nature. Who you are is non-judging awareness. And who you are as loving presence. And sensing at the same time the simplicity of this practice, aware of the breath, aware of sound and feeling. Deeply relaxed, at the same time alert. In any moment, you can arrive and relax and feel that sense of the mystery. And gently deepening your breath. And when you're ready, you can let your eyes open. May you and your inner critic have a wonderful evening together. Thank you for your kind presence. Quick announcement. I believe next week is President's Day on Monday, so we will have no class.